Accession number 10161, reel number 1.
Colonel Slater, reel 1. When was it that you became involved in the Malayan Emergency, Colonel?
Well, I was serving with the Northern Rhodesia Regiment out in Northern Rhodesia in 1953, and the War Office had asked East Africa, for the King's African Rifles, the Northern Rhodesia Regiment, to take turns in a tour in Malaya because of the good jungle fighting qualities of the African troops. And it so happened that our turn, the Northern Rhodesia Regiment turn, came up, and we were selected to go to Malaya round about September, October of 1953, and we took over from the 2nd King's African Rifles.
Before we go on to Malaya, could I ask you about the particular qualities of the Northern Rhodesian soldier? What were his military and personal qualities, as say, compared with the British soldier?
Yes, I can give you a bit of background on that, because I was with the Northern Rhodesia Regiment for a large part of the last war. They are, as you can imagine, good at not guerrilla warfare, but warfare rather like that, not in European type warfare, in colonial disturbances and jungle training and jungle fighting. They are very good at that. They were used in Burma, and also, of course, in East Africa, where they assisted the South Africans to overcome the Italians. And that's the type of warfare that they're very good at. So I presume that they were selected for Malaya when the emergency started because of their jungle background of good fighting troops in the jungle.
Why would they be not so suited to a European theatre?
Well, I think that being more, what is the word, being more closer to the country to the than an ordinary European type soldier is, he does not stand up in to heavy bombardments or shelling or mortar or bombing for very long. He'd rather find his way through the bush on patrols and that sort of thing. He's not a sort of trench warfare soldier.
Do they have much of a hunting instinct?
Yes. Going forward a little bit, when we got to Malaya, other regiments, British regiments, used to have guides and scouts from Sarawak and Borneo. We dispensed with them. We used them when we first arrived, but after a bit we found that our soldiers, our troops, our scouts were just as good as them.
What about specific military qualities like marksmanship, smartness, efficiency, and so on?
Marksmanship, like most soldiers, most armies I've been in, varied. I would say that they were average shots, but when you found a good marksman, he was a very good one. Discipline, military discipline, and smartness on parade, outstanding in their limited ways of discipline. They had a very good sense of humour, and if you humoured them along, the world was yours with them. On military on parade, that sort of thing, I can only say from personal experience in that when I was commanding the Northern Rhodesia Regiment, the Queen Mother came out to Northern Rhodesia and presented us with new colours. And we had a very large parade, and after it was over, I got a letter from her private secretary to say that the Queen Mother had never ever seen such an outstanding parade as the one she had just seen. And I take that as a great compliment from the Queen Mother, who has seen many hundreds, no doubt, of trooping the, presentation of colour parades.
On discipline, do you mean that you would have fewer discipline problems with Northern Rhodesian troops than you would with the British soldier?
You would have... No, I don't think so. But you would probably have different types of problems. You would have, surprisingly enough, very few charges for being drunk or disorderly. But you would get more family problems about overstaying their leave because their wife was sick or something like that, you see. Instead of, they would just go off and to see their wives, and then they would come back late. And so one had to really adjust one's discipline to that.
Which particular sections of the Northern Rhodesian community were they recruited from?
In my time, we recruited from three main areas. The Eastern Province, where we the border between Nyasaland, as then was, and Eastern Province of Northern Rhodesia, split the tribes, really, went right through the tribes, and we recruited there for the Ngoni and the Chewa, which were related to the Ngoni. They were, I suppose, our number one recruiting area for their fighting qualities. We recruited from the Barotseland province of Northern Rhodesia, mainly the Ila, who were a great fighting tribe, and huntsmen would go out and get their lions. They would blood themselves with their first lion, the young chaps coming up. And we would recruit from the northern province, the Bemba, a large tribe up there, very well educated, and they provided us with our, to a large extent, with our clerks and signalers and drivers and that sort of thing.
Were there any tribes who weren't favoured for recruitment?
No. We would recruit from any tribe, provided the person, when he came up and said he wanted to join the army, was fit and passed our tests. So we had a broad sprinkling of tribes from all over Northern Rhodesia.
Would the different tribes be mixed together in the same platoon, or kept separated in different units?
Oh no, completely intermingled.
Why was that?
Well, we found it better that instead of having, like in the Indian Army, you would have a company of Bemba or a company of Ngoni. Well, then you were just simply building up two rival tribal antagonists, you see. So we simply came in, and there was a vacancy in a company for a person. He went there, irrespective of where his tribe came from.
So were you trying to... Was it a deliberate policy of trying to break down tribal divisions?
No, it wasn't a deliberate policy. It was... a policy we adapted, which we found was best.
Did you have any personal preferences for any of these tribal groups?
Well, I suppose one... yes, I suppose so. I suppose after 3-4 years there, you would see that... an Ila person was a really very great, tall, strong, strapping man that you could trust. Your Bemba would be your intelligent section, your driver, who you could also trust to get you there. And your Ngoni was a the backbone of perhaps a company or a section who would give you more fighting qualities that you needed.
Were any of them Muslims or Christians or pagans or what?
There were a smattering of Muslims from the eastern province, Nyasaland area, because you get from a few from there, from the old Arab days. But by and large, they were of Roman Catholics, Church of England, and if you ask them what religion they were, they wouldn't tell you that they were Anglicans or Church of England. They would tell you what school they went to, London Missionary School or something like that. Then you would guess what sort of religion they were. But by and large, it was Roman Catholic, probably predominated, and Anglicans.
Did religion play any part at all in the battalion?
In the
battalion?
Yes, we had services. We would have certainly in barracks. We would have service once a week on a Sunday.
Was much value placed on religion in the unit?
The same as in a British regiment, really. A lot of them would do their own little religious services. You'd walk down through the barracks and on a Sunday, and there they would be sitting down, a small group of them, 20 or 30 of them, having a little sing-song.
Would you have a padre system?
We didn't have padres as such, but we would have padres from outside. The local parson would come and take us in under his fold, that sort of thing. He'd come and
Was there a lingua franca?
Yes, there was a lingua franca, and it was, in my day, it was Chinyanja. Because, as I told you, we recruited, number one recruiting area was Eastern Province. That was the lingua franca there, and it became the regimental lingua franca.
What about the use of English? Was that encouraged at all in the regiment?
Yes, English was used, but like rather in the Indian Army, we all Europeans had to take a test, a Nyanja test, within 6 months of joining, and pass the regimental test.
How did you get to Malaya?
I was on the advance party with the company commanders and advance companies, parties from each company. We flew from the RAF, flew us in a Hastings from Lusaka to Nairobi, from Nairobi to Aden, from Aden to Karachi, from Karachi to Colombo, and from Colombo to Singapore. The rest of the battalion came on later by troop ship from, I wasn't with them and I'm not quite sure, but the battalion later on went from Beira.
How did the African troops react to flying?
Well, like most things, they just adapted themselves to it, took it in their stride. It was there The orders were to get on the aircraft and fly, and they flew.
So they obviously seem to have great trust in you.
Yes.
How did they react to serving overseas? Was there any problem about service outside of Central Africa?
No. No problem at all, because in fact they liked it, they enjoyed it, they got extra money, extra pay, and better benefits, so that it was very good for them.
Did you give them any kind of briefing as to what the situation was in Malaya and what they were who they were supposed to be fighting against?
Oh yes, the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland was coming up. It's on the political side of, in that part of the world, and the 22 Squadron Special Air Service, the Rhodesian one, had just come back from Malaya, and they sent people up to us to brief us and put us into the picture about what to expect when we went to Malaya.
What exactly was put to the African troops about the nature of the enemy? Did you explain about communism or Chinese and
yes,
Malayas and so on?
Yes, in general terms. It was explained to them whom we were fighting, the type of person we were fighting, and the terrain into which we were going to fight.
Would the word communism mean anything to them?
No, I don't think so. It was just that there was a communist insurrection in Malaya, and we were required to help.
What happened once you got to Malaya?
Well, as I said, the company commanders were on the advance party. We did a jungle training course at Kota Tinggi in Johor Bahru. By the time the battalion arrived in Singapore, we had completed our course, and we then rejoin the battalion. We had a short while in which to put the training over to the battalion at Kota Tinggi. The battalion went there, so we retrained our companies actually at the training camp. We had done the course. We went into the bush, into the jungle from that area, and had about, I think it was about a month there, so that the whole of the battalion got the training from the advance party, and we then went to our operational area.
What type of things were learned at Kota Tinggi?
Jungle drills, how to set up a base camp, how to patrol, how to report back on the wireless, airdrops, rations, demands, map reading. Those were the main basic things we taught there, especially the jungle drills, the immediate reaction to any bumping of the CT.
How much of this was new to the troops?
We had been training in Northern Rhodesia on those lines for about 6 months before we left. So the jungle drills, the battalion, the commanding officer, Colonel Good, found an area in Northern Rhodesia which was as akin to, as possible to Malaya, and we trained on our own in those areas.
What about the question of opening fire in the jungle? Would they expect to shout a warning to people, or just open fire if they saw somebody?
No, it was just open fire, because in the areas of the jungle you went into, the only other person that you saw was a CT.
How did the troops take to the jungle warfare training?
They were very good. They were extremely good at setting up camps. We were in very much more comfort than the British troops, because the African is very good with his panga, and a few sticks, branches, and he'd have a bed for you. He'd set up your hammock. We all had a hammock, and they were a lovely little base camp one would have within half an hour or so. Instead of lying on the ground, one would be in a proper hammock slung up between the trees.
But what was the bed of sticks for then?
Well, some people didn't like hammocks, and they would have a little bed made and lie on it.
Was that British people or African people who didn't like the hammocks?
Some of the Africans didn't like hammocks.
Was there anything about Malaya which caused surprise or amusement to the African troops?
Yes, I think they were very impressed by the local population's way of farming. Any level piece of ground was used for paddy, and or an orchard of fruit trees. He was impressed with this, because his own farming methods, of course, as you probably know, is just to go out into the bush and plant his mealies.
How did he get on with the local people, or did he not come into contact with them?
They didn't come into contact with them very much. Once coming back from the jungle into the battalion's area, they would rather stay back in their own camp rather than go out into the local town or village. They would much prefer to stay back and have their own ngoma in their...
What's an ngoma?
An ngoma is a party where it doesn't take long for the African to brew his beer from mealy meal, and that's brewed there, and very quickly brewed, quite a potent, not a very nice tasting type of beer, and he would much rather sit round his own campfire in the barracks, drinking that, nattering, talking, having a little sing-song, and the ngoma is probably brought out and beaten and makes a little bit of background music.
I mean, ngoma's a drum, is it?
Yes.
And would there be dancing at an ngoma?
Oh yes, I expect so.
Were there any sources of friction between the troops and the local people?
No, we never had any problems with that at all.
What about the troops relating to local women? Was there any of that?
No. In my experience, we had none of that. I should say here that there was a East African leave camp to which the troops went to. I never went there myself, but they would go down there for a fortnight. I think it was near Malacca, and they would go down there for a fortnight and rest and recuperate. And they may well have met females down there. But certainly in my experience up at the Sharp End, where we were most of the time, there was no problem.
Did they use local prostitutes?
Not as far as I was aware.
Did that seem to bother them, that there was little female company?
Surprisingly enough, no, it didn't.
Would they have much contact with home in the way of letters?
Oh yes, the letters, standard letters, airmail letters sent back, and they'd get their mail. Of course, there's not much writing, as you can imagine, from Africa to Malaya. It would They would probably write once a month or something like that and get a letter back once a month.
Would your troops normally be literate?
About 80%, I should think.
Did they seem to be homesick at all whilst they were there? Did you get complaints on those lines?
No. They knew the length of stay that they were going to be there, which was just over a year and 4 months. And like everybody else, they were anxious to get home. But they accepted it that this was part of their job.
So they wouldn't always be asking you when they were going home?
No.
Can you tell me where you were based for operations?
Yes, the battalion started its operations on the 5th of December 1954, and the whole battalion was stationed in Kuala Lumpur in Pahang State.
What kind of an area was this for the degree of guerrilla warfare?
Well, we went there purely because we took over from 2KAR, who were in that area. We arrived. They were out on patrol. My company was the first company to go in, so we went in to take over from 2KAR, my company, and another company went in the next day and took over from the same company of 2KR and that sort of thing. That's why we were there, of course. The battalion headquarters and the companies were on Benta Airstrip, which is about 8 miles from outside Kuala Lumpur, where there was an army Auster squadron. So we shared the airstrip with them.
Did you say Benta?
Benta, B-E-N-T-A.
But was this an area where the guerrillas were powerful or not?
Yes, they were. Kluang was a very bad state for guerrillas, for the CTs, and there were still a number of CT bands to be cleared up in and around Kuala Lumpur. In fact, when we went in on that day, on the 5th of December, within 10 minutes we had a contact. Unfortunately, it was not successful and the man got away.
How did that come about?
Well, it just happened that we were brand new to going into the jungle, as it were, for the first time with live ammunition up the spout. And movement was seen down the track. We were going through a wood cutting area to get into the proper jungle, and we saw a movement on the track. The platoon commander, John Lyons, opened fire on it, where the movement was. We followed up hard for about 20 minutes, 30 minutes, but we'd lost contact. It was a man in black, incidentally, a man in black. And the man in black turned out to be one of the leading communists, Osman, I can't remember his full name, who gave himself up fairly shortly afterwards.